Hi, this is Jacob Scher. Welcome to the Job Mob Podcast. Welcome to part two of my interview with Nat Gordon, Israel's best-known recruiter for English-based jobs. If you didn't listen to part one of this interview, it's pretty easy to find. Just go on to JobMob, which is, of course, at jobmob.co.il, and use the search bar on top. Type in Nat, N-A-T, Gordon, G-O-R-D-O-N. Click the search button, and in the results, you can see the part one part of the interview, and just click through to listen to that on the site or download it. And now we'll just jump right into part two. Enjoy this. It's a lot more, this part of the interview is a lot more focused on not only, but also discusses a lot of tips about resume writing. And a lot of these tips are tips that are good for anybody in the world. They're not specific to Israel at all. Towards the end of the interview, Nat comes back to talking about ideas that are specific to Israel, but still interestingly read, or listen rather, for anybody that's out there in the job mob community. So enjoy the rest of my interview with Nat Gordon, and I'll talk to you again as usual at the end of the interview.
Employers will not put all their jobs on their websites.
Okay, why not?
Well, the jobs they won't put on, I'll give you a dramatic example, is they won't put the job for their finance director if they're wanting to sack their current finance director because they're not happy with them. Now, they're not going to advertise that on their website or on any other website because the guy doesn't know he's getting the boot. And they're going to come to a proper headhunter that will work in total discretion and will find, not necessarily steal from another company, but will find from his own sources an alternative candidate who will be interviewed in a hotel or in the headhunter's office. And the guy will be offered the job, and it's only when he's got the job will they say to the other guy, look, I want the keys and the keys of the safe, please. Here's three times the amount of pizza and severance pay, and then the job has been done. So there will always be a need, however sophisticated the internet gets for job seekers, there will always be a need for headhunters at the top confidentiality end of the market. There will also always be a need for the lower end temporary workers. If a client of ours or anybody has got an English secretary and she's got to be ill for 5 days and they need a replacement for 5 days, they are simply not going to be able to find them. Putting them on either their website or on a job portal, what they want is to phone up marksmen and say, can you have someone there for tomorrow morning to work 5 days or as long as it may seem. And that will also be, so the employment businesses will change. The place for a employment agency doing everything will probably diminish. They will become specialized agencies, headhunting agencies or temporary agencies or job portals themselves. And there's one very big agency in England, Hayes, I think it's called, who put up their own jobs on their website. It's a huge website. But they also allow clients to pay them to put up their jobs themselves. Now, how they don't see that as a conflict of interest, I'm not sure, but it seems to work. It seems to work because it brings more and more traffic, that's the word, more traffic to the website. And simply that's the name of the game. For some reason, people like to go to a site that that's absolutely ungestopft, I'm sorry, it's Yiddish, absolutely stuffed with jobs, that gives them cover, which to me, I think is mad, because really you want to find the site where your specific niche and the particular job that you want is there, unless, of course, you're in the category, as many are, of you don't know what kind of job you want. You just got to look through the jobs and, oh, that sounds good, that sounds good, that sounds good, which is not a very scientific way to actually choose.
Okay, and I'm going to go back to something you were saying earlier. You were talking about how sometimes people will confetti, they will send along the resume to 200 agencies at the same time, stupidly. And so what are other kinds of mistakes that you see people doing when they're approaching recruiters like Marksman?
Look, there aren't that many recruiters like Marksman. I'm not just, there aren't, because most of them are temporary agencies, or general agencies. What they should do? They should be honest with their CV. Now, I know it's illegal in America to put your age on your CV. But what help is it not putting your age on your CV? At the end of the day, it's going to have to come out in the wash. If the client doesn't want somebody over 42, then I have to say, in great sadness, that seems to be the magic age when people are already old to get a new job. And it's not just here, it's abroad. What's it going to help not to put the age and to get yourself an interview that they discover you're older? Well, but companies normally, and it's perfectly acceptable, want to have the right kind of fix within their company. If it's a company that's got a lot of 20 and 30 year old women there, they're not wanting a 70 year old man, because they're not going to be, their current workers are not going to feel comfortable, either is the guy going to feel comfortable. And you can take that really quite a long way down the line. So why the secrecy about age or sex? Not sex, but the size of your family. If you're married, you should be proud you're married. You should be proud you've got four kids. And you should be proud to tell us how old the kids are. Because if it's a job where it's got to require a lot of overtime, what's the point in being invited for an interview and then to say, well, I never got the job because I've got kids? You know, that might well be the reason. It might well be the reason.
But do you want to work for someone who would do that?
Would you want to work for someone to do it? You might, you know, you wouldn't, exactly. So that's another reason for honesty. So I say, in terms of, and obviously in the CV, to put your skills, but not any comments about how good you are. I'm a well-orientated, career-minded, all those totally biased comments, because you're showing off yourself. That's childish. Scientists, in fact, often have the best CVs. They state who they are, where they're educated, what papers they wrote, where they're working now. And some, when they're applying for jobs outside industry, will say, I'm currently on this salary.
In their CV?
In their CV.
Interesting.
Which means that the guy reading the CV says, well, if I want doctor this, I'm going to have to pay him at least what he's getting at the moment.
So do you recommend that people regularly put their salary? If they're a professional.
I didn't normally, but in today's market, when people are looking for best value for money, if you're willing to work for 6,500 shekels a month for 180 hours, why not put it on the CV? It's got to be a value added. The biggest concept of writing a CV is to think about the person who's reading. Don't think about yourself. It's not a ego trip. I am great. I am great. I am this. I've done this. I've done this. I love children. I ski. I do this. I do that. No. But what you want to show the guy who's reading it that you've got experience doing what he wants, that you're living close enough, not PO boxes, that you're living close enough to where he's got his job, that you've got experience in it, that you've had some general other experience. And even though there was a job that you loved looking after horses, to put a two paragraph details about you looking for caring for horses when you're applying for a job as a technical writer, it's my mind, madness. You just want to mention it as one liner because it's not relevant. The guy who's reading it shouldn't see it's relevant. And then, of course, if you can state, I'm currently unemployed and was earning a salary of that. So the guys reading it will get it. Now, why put it on the CV and not on the accompanying letter?
What do you mean by company letter?
Normally, you send a CV by email,
Okay.
and you send an email and you say, attached, please find my CV. And then you go on to say, I'm a very nice person, blah, 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 I'm working this, da, da,
Okay,
da, da,
the
da.
cover letter.
The cover letter.
Okay,
The
sorry.
cover letter. I would almost ban cover letters because there should be nothing that you want to say in the cover letter that you should be ashamed of or not point out in your CV. And the best CVs are one page. Because remember, the CV is going to be read not by one person. If you're getting to the point of getting a CV and then getting a job, then it's good. You must have a whole selection of CVs. And if you're applying for a specific job, and that's the beauty of going to a specialist niche agency, where you could actually see the description of the job, where it is, what the salary is, and whatever. And if it's a job that's advertised at a salary range between 6,000 and 8,000, you're currently working in a job for 10,000, but you fancy that, then you should. That's a key part, because that's got to be crucial whether you get the job or whether you want to go for the job. You can't just apply for it in the hope that you're going to convince them at the end of the interview to give you 10,000. I assure you, we the agency have worked very hard to try to get them to put 78,000, to get Israelis to actually admit a salary is itself something. And if they've said 78, they mean 78, they don't mean 7 to 10. That you put down, I'm currently earning 10,000. The vacancy is closer to home and is more in the area that I'm willing to. So I'm willing to start at 8,000. Now that's a different story. So you're doing that.
Because all of a sudden they're getting more value than what they expected.
They're getting much more value than they expected. That's right. And that the client reading it, and that you're writing it not for yourself, you're writing it for the client. The client is saying, ah, this guy seems to know what we're about. And when a
So
client.
where would you write that though? Would you write that in the cover letter, or you write that on the CV itself?
The first paragraph.
Of the CV?
On the first paragraph, there's a first paragraph I always suggest is written as current career objectives.
Okay.
I would like to go into this particular marketing communications. Although I've always been just a technical writer, I'm currently earning 10,000, but I'm happy to start at the 8,000 in order to get experience in the Markov field and to prove myself with your company. that will be read, and it will continue to be read, so that through the process of the person receiving the CV, the human resources department, if it has to go through, and then the manager, and then the people doing the interview, they will all see this, and they'll probably not talk about salary, because you've already broken the most difficult problem. Israelis hate to talk about salary until the very end. They'll give you three interviews, and they'll have you sitting, you know, well, when could I start? But before that, just could you, you've not mentioned the salary. Well, we pay quite well here. Tell me, and what do we pay here? I'll ask the accountant.
But they'll ask you what you want.
And then they'll say, what is it that you'd like? Now, right, if that's the fact of life, accept it. So right from the start, say what they want. Tell them that I'm great value. You have to sell yourself. Mm-hmm. Of course, it is much easier if your CV is presented by an agency who has got a good relationship with an intelligent client. Now, there's an awful lot of ifs there. If the client is intelligent, if the client is amenable, if the recruitment consultant is doing his job properly, right. If you are honest with the recruitment consultant, there's a lot of ifs there. But if you do that, then of course the chances are better.
Okay, so how many CVs, I mean, you must be getting so many CVs on a regular basis.
Correct.
How can someone stand out, just for you even, to get your attention so that you can then take their CV onto someone else?
We're no different from the client. First of all, if it's a 5-page CV, we're just human. We're not going to be...
But do you look at every CV you get?
We look at every CV we get, because we've got two things about. We're not just recruiting for that specific job, though we are. We're looking at the CV in two lights. Would they be suitable for the job they've applied to? And conceivably, would they be good for our stock? Because we get requests for people like him in the future. So when you send to an agency rather than to a client directly, you've got the advantage that the agency might think of considering you for a future position. Okay. But for the current position, we've got exactly the same concerns. We know what we advertised on the website. We know what the criteria we've asked for, and we judge if the guy is if he hides information, then it's very frustrating.
Okay.
Very frustrating.
Well, I mean, there's only so much. You were saying, well, you recommend a 1-page CV.
Yes, absolutely.
So there's only so much you can say in 1 page. So in a way, a lot is hidden. No.
No. Not at all. Not at all. No. You could, if you've been in a lot of jobs, but they're all been much the same, you could put from 1992 to 2005, worked in 5 telemarketing companies in the Forex industry. You don't need to put all 5 of them down.
Okay.
That wastes the person's time, but it does have an impression. Wow, there were 10 years in the industry. Rather than, if you put each job individually, they say, this guy's a job hopper. Yeah. He's not stable.
Oh, interesting, good point. Okay.
You know, there are thousands of ways of doing it.
Mm-hmm.
I've never known anyone, and even scientists who've got, you know, 40 papers they've written, in their initial CV, at the bottom they say, you could say, papers I have written myself or an association, 20 papers on the subject of blah, 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 which will be sent to you if you're interested or something like that. And so you could get, even a scientist could get their basic facts on a 1-page CV.
Okay. And so how do you, if you're someone who has a long experience, let's say 20 years, above the 42, the magic 42 age number, and so how do they condense What kinds of things should they look at when they want to condense it into a page?
Well, it's only a matter of years. It's not a matter of quality or time. Somebody came to me, was looking for a job as, I think she got a job as a secretary. And she said, but, I've got, you know, 18 years experience as a bank teller. And she went on about it until I wasn't rude, I think. I said, hey, hold on. You've not got 18 years experience as a teller, but I do. I said, you've got 1 year's experience as a bank teller 18 times over. Because it's not progressive experience. Sometimes in some jobs, it is progressive experience. If you're a bus driver, for 5 years, you think, well, that's reasonable, good, he's got experience. Does the experience, because he's got 40 years experience as a bus driver, does that make him any better than 5 years? Very, in fact, probably not. In fact, on the contrary, because he's so fixed in his concepts and he's got so much experience in doing one particular job, like she had 80 years job being a bank teller. You also sometimes want a bit of movement. Somebody who's in the same company for 25 years sometimes frightens the heck out of potential employers. Oh, he'll be telling us what to do. And perhaps that is one of the last points I think I would like to say, is that 40 or 50% of the CVs that we reject are because the candidates are overqualified.
The magic word.
Or give the impression they're overqualified.
Okay.
Now, we know that they're not really overqualified, but they've got a lot of degrees, they've got a lot of blah blah, they've got one MBA from here and one MBA from a useless university here as well, or one from they look and they can frighten off employers dreadfully. And I have even on some occasions told people to take off some of their degrees, take off some of their information. And their titles. See, some people work for a one-man company and call themselves the CEO. Now, and they apply for a job as administrative assistant. Now, the guy employing them is frightened to death. What do I want a CEO? You know, to help me open the letters in the morning. People don't realise that the image that their CV gives them is important. So, look, the basic principle comes back again. When you write your CV, don't write it as my life story. Write it as, this document has got to be read by a guy who's got that particular vacancy. What does he want to hear from me? Maybe halfway through you'll come to the conclusion, you know, I'm not really suitable for that job. And that's good. Better not to send it. Because you're not saving his time. You're not saving your own time as well.
And so when people come to you, what's a typical process? When you've had a CV and you say, okay, this is someone who's a match, what happens?
Well, they're brought in and interviewed. Okay. They're brought in and interviewed and they're told about the job.
You always do a test?
Not always. Sometimes, if somebody's applying for a job as a bookkeeper and they've had 3 years experience as a bookkeeper, and then they worked in a bank for 2 years, then went back and worked in a lawyer's office, an accountant's office, mm-hmm. for 5 years. So clearly, they've got the right personality. They've chosen to apply for a bookkeeping job. They've got the certificates. And incidentally, in Israel, I have to say we're very lucky. We have a very honest set of applicants. Very, very rarely have I ever known anyone to claim they've got a certificate or experience or worked for somewhere they haven't. It's happened to be abroad, but not in Israel. We can be proud of that. So when people say they've got a certificate, they normally have. And then the interview would be relatively easy. We would then reveal to the applicant who the client is, mm-hmm. what the job is, what history we know about them, whether the office allows smokers or doesn't allow smokers, mm-hmm. whether it's upstairs, whether it's difficult to get by bus.
You basically try to help them because you want them to get the job once you...
Sure, we only earn a fee when they get the right. job. Mm-hmm. So already when they've come in here, we have a gut feeling that they could be a potential applicant. And because we've got respect for our clients, we don't send them fodder, just people to do it. There's also, look, there are plenty shtiklich and tricklich. There's the intrigues that go on in employment.
Some, what do you mean?
Well, companies know exactly who they want to employ for this job, but they have to put an advert in the paper because, you know, their brother-in-law will not get the job if there's not other applicants. And so they will, Dafka's what's, how do you translate? Anyway, it doesn't matter. My English. Choose poor candidates so that the brother-in-law will shine. So these things do happen, and there's nothing in the world you can do about it. C'est la vie, that's life.
What about classic myths in Israel, like you have to be a soldier? Is that also something that you still come up against?
No, it's not quite. I mean, everybody's a soldier, so it's not quite that. It obviously helps if you've got the corporate image, the corporate personality, that if you're applying to a job and clearly everybody has been in the army and the you'd have more in common, and they would also know that, and at coffee break you'd be able to talk about things, so it'd be more comfortable for everybody. The same in tax, in terms of religion, that of course, like sex, you're not allowed to say I only want this or I only want that. But clearly companies where they have non-kosher food and where they have a dress style that is not totally relevant to a religious person would not be the right place for a religious person. And that's not bias or say, you know, they won't allow any religious people working there. It's that most religious people wouldn't want to work there. And there's a cultural culture. On the other side as well, that there are companies that are not just Haredi companies, but other organizations that have got maybe a high proportion of religious people in it. And they feel more comfortable with religious people working. And that's perfectly legitimate. Now, is that biasing? Is that bias? I don't know if it's
or
biased.
Legal. I mean, legally.
Legally, but very difficult to say. Yeah. It's very difficult to say. I mean, what about, you know, when you talk about legalities and bias? I understand that I think about 80% of the people working in Ben Gurion Airport, schlepping the collecting the suitcases and things like that. All come from the same family, are related. Now, do you have to be a member of that family to get a job there? Clearly not, but it doesn't hurt.
Yeah.
Now, it probably helps discipline a huge amount, because, you know, when you're working within your family, you're aware not to do anything stupid, because it's, you're not just affecting your job, you're affecting your whole social standing. So there are reasons as well. It is difficult. In Israel, the laws, well, it's very controversial at the moment about working on Shabbat. I think there's now attempts to crack down, or to whatever, if that's the right word, it might not be, on quite a lot of illegal working on Shabbat by Jews. Very difficult to get the right balance. Very, very difficult. Obviously, in airports and hospitals, there are clear permissions to do it. In other places, there isn't. And what do you do when a Jewish person is wanting a job that does require work on Shabbat, and you introduce them to that job, and the employer is breaking the law? Are you party to that breaking
as
the law?
As a recruiter, you mean?
As a recruiter, right. Think about it.
Well, do you know in advance?
Of course you know in advance. It's very difficult, very difficult. Okay.
I just one last thing I wanted to ask. I appreciate it. That's a nice long hour. It's been great. Are there any standout stories from your experience of either of complete nightmare candidates for whatever specific reason, unusual reason, or just it was a lightning fast, something that was just so natural?
Oh, of course, over the years, there's been cases of somebody phoning up, asking for someone, and someone walking in the door 1 minute later, and they end up being absolutely perfect. Mm-hmm. But that happens. It's very unusual.
Very rare.
Very rare. There are also cases of people who came for an interview, because we've been going for a long time, we've been going since 1982, who came for an interview for a job 15 years after they'd been before.
Oh, a repeat candidate
who had reduced her age by 10 years the second time.
Okay.
But had actually put her age on there and reduced it by 10 years. And now that I will always remember that one. I've also had a very interesting history with some candidates that I've placed several times. Not that they're job hoppers, just that you know, the time has gone, and after 3 or 4 years they want another job, and the first thing they come back to us, we place them in another job. And I think I've got somebody I've placed 3 times, which is very nice.
But I mean, isn't it encouraging for you, because you know if you've successfully placed someone, then you probably could do it again, because it was already a success, a track record.
Oh, of course. The best people, of course, are people that there, and they're the ones who recommend friends and family to them, and that's that of course helps. That helps. So the personal aspect, despite all the computers, is useful. But that's assuming that the clients want that use.
Okay, in what sense?
As I said, is that the business in England and America is called search and selection. Mm-hmm. In where the agency is paid to find people and to select them. Now in Israel, because most companies have, for whatever reason, have personnel officers or managers who come from an army background and think they know how to manage men, really don't want the second. All they really want us is to send them CVs and they take it from there. So that is a bit frustrating because you don't get the satisfaction of doing the selection. And that means you don't really learn that much more about the company or about the individual. You don't know the criteria.
Because it's harder.
It's much, well, harder or easier. I mean, if the clients are just happy with 10 CVs and they choose from there, we get our fee anyway. It is, but it's not terribly professionally satisfying. You don't feel that you've done the job. But on the other hand, we just have to accept the fact we don't get paid to be search and selectors. I mean, in England and America, the average fee for a placement is 20% of an annual salary. Now it used to be 30%, but it's now probably now 20%. In Israel, the average fee was 1 month's salary, which is 8 1/3%, less than half. So I suppose if they're paying less than half, I suppose they're only expecting less than half of the service.
Interesting. Okay, well, thank you so much for your time.
It's a pleasure.
Lots
it's
of interesting information for people to follow up on.
Thank you.
And I hope that it brings some interesting candidates your way that you can place.
Yes, and and some interesting jobs as well would be nice in today's market. Thank you very much.
Jacob Scher here again. I love that story about Ben Gurion Airport and the family that works there. It's just too funny. If you're looking for a job right now, an English-based job in Israel, or perhaps you're actually an employer who's looking to hire people for an English-based job, then go to Marksman. Marksman is marksman.co.il to find all the information that you'll need there from Nat Gordon and his team. And if you'd like to hear more podcasts, as usual, the URL for the rest of the podcast archive that we've done on JobMob here is jobmob.co.il/podcasts, PODCASTS. Thank you again for listening, and I'll talk to you again soon.